It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out what happens when virtual unreality becomes part of the real world.
First, we're talking about the Supreme Court's ruling in the Hobby Lobby case announced this morning. Hobby Lobby successfully challenged the mandate to cover birth control as part of the Affordable Care Act on religious grounds. They said some kinds of contraception, like Plan B, are tantamount to abortion.
Here to explain the greater implications of this ruling is Alta Shero. She's professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. Alta, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the basics here. What exactly was Hobby Lobby and one other company challenging in court?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, what most people call Obamacare, requires that employers that have more than 50 employees, that is larger employers, provide the full range of preventive health measures without making people pay for them. It's good public health policy. But that includes contraception, and that was a recommendation from our National Academy of Sciences. So Hobby Lobby is a very large company with over 570 stores, but it's what we call a closely held corporation. It's just a small number of people who own the majority of the stock, and the two primary owners are very religious. They said they did not want to have to comply with this requirement because it would have to provide health care insurance that would include coverage for forms of contraception that they object to. One thing that's worth noting is that they actually did cover exactly these kinds of contraceptives for years. Dropped the coverage in 2012 and then filed this suit. So there is some question about exactly how much it's an objection to the policy and how much it's actually a religious objection. But that did not play a role in the court's decision.
And the majority said, yes, in fact, this would infringe on the religious liberty of Hobby Lobby and other corporations in a similar status. This doesn't apply to all companies or corporations everywhere, though, does it? How narrow is this ruling?
It does not. How narrow it is a little unclear. So it does not apply to public corporations, the ones that have stocks traded in the stock market. But about half of the corporations in the United States are what we closely held, and they would all be the kind that are now the subject of this decision, where we're now talking about the corporation, not the owners, but the corporation itself having a religious viewpoint that can be burdened by a generally applicable law like providing comprehensive health care insurance.
And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the dissent. What concerns did she raise there?
Well, she had several concerns. The first one was her concern at talking about corporations having a religious viewpoint. It's certainly novel in American law. We've never thought of corporations that way. It seems to be an expansion of a very controversial decision earlier about corporations having free speech rights that played into the financing for campaign. Her second concern was that the court, which was interpreting a statute from the 1990s, which prohibited a substantial burden being placed on religion unless there was a compelling purpose that had to be managed by the government. She said, where's the substantial burden here? I mean, these people are not being told they have to use birth control. They're not being told they have to support birth control. Their employees may or may not use the birth control. All they're doing is providing the health care insurance, and they have an option, which is they can just say, well, we won't provide health care insurance at all. They pay $2,000 per employee to the government, and now the employees go out onto the public Obamacare exchange, which is subsidized by the public. So she said there's no real burden here. This is a very tenuous argument for complicity with an act they view as immoral, and that really has a lot of implications for many other ways in which people could now argue that they feel complicit in what they view as immoral acts by even paying a salary or by taking a photograph or opening up a venue to people to marry that they don't approve of. So this notion of burden and complicity is actually very important.
Well, even if it doesn't spread that widely, one concern is that if there are religious concerns to covering, say, a medicine developed with stem cell research or animal research, if somebody's religious views preclude that, could that be a likelihood in the next couple of years?
Well, I think it's entirely possible. I don't know how likely it is. Certainly, a lot of what's going on now is driven entirely by opposition to the Affordable Care Act or by abortion politics. So we have to figure out how likely it is to extend to other areas. But you mentioned one, embryonic stem cell research, that is also tied to the abortion debate. And second, almost as controversial, has been same-sex marriage. And these are areas where I actually can easily imagine a closely held corporation bringing a suit saying that they don't want to have to abide by some general federal law, that because they view it as making them somehow complicit in an action they view as somehow immoral. There are even certain vaccines that were originally developed with fetal tissue that could be incorporated into this as well. So we could see healthcare insurance that does not cover vaccinations for your children for chickenpox and German measles.
Briefly, some people have challenged the notion of birth control as an important part of preventive care. Briefly, can you talk about that?
Sure. Birth control is actually a very ordinary part of life. 99% of women use some kind of form of birth control in their lifetime. And we now have seen that they are not all the same. They come in varying degrees of effectiveness. And here's the challenge. The ones that are the most effective are also the most expensive, things like the intrauterine device, because once it's in, it works. You don't have to take a pill every day. There's no problem with forgetting or your partner not putting on a condom. So these things are extremely effective. And about 1 out of 3 women who use contraception say they prefer to use something like an IUD, but they can't afford it. It can cost as much as a month's salary for a low-income woman. So if we really want to reduce the number of unintended pregnancies, about half of which, by the way, result in abortions, we could try to make it easier for women to afford the best forms of contraception. Then they don't get pregnant when they don't want to, and then we reduce the number of abortions, which is one of the things everybody can agree is a good idea.
We'll leave it there for now. Alta, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That's Alta Shero. She's professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. The internet has revolutionized how we gather and consume information. It's also made a huge amount of info available to anyone interested in finding it.
Well, the digital revolution has leveled the information playing field. It also means that anyone with a device and a Wi-Fi connection can publish and manipulate data.
So, how can we figure out what is truth and what's fiction in this new online world?
With us now is Charles Seif, professor of journalism at New York University and the author of Virtual Unreality. Just because the internet told you so, how do you know it's true? Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you start your book with a story about how a Sesame Street character went from being the star of one guy's whimsical pet website to kind of an actual player in Middle East imaging and politics. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, that was a very curious story. There was this website for a number of years early on the web called Bert is Evil. And it was one of these joke websites where some people photoshopped Bert, the Muppet character, into various historical situations, like an evil Forrest Gump or an evil Zelig. So they photoshopped a picture of Bert sitting behind Hitler or consulting with Pol Pot or riding along with Stalin. And they also created one with Bert standing behind the shoulder of Osama bin Laden. And it was just this joke, and it circulated around the web. People laughed. But then September 11th happened, and there was a series of protests in the Middle East and Indonesia supporting Osama bin Laden. And there were a number of print shops that put out posters of Osama bin Laden with his picture on it. And on one of these posters, there behind Osama bin Laden's shoulder was Bert. And there it was in Indonesia. People were marching along, shouting, "Down with the USA," holding up placards with the lovable Muppet Bert in support of Osama bin Laden. So what happened with this idea, this joke idea that Bert is evil, crystallized and became real. He actually became evil in some sense, hanging out with Osama bin Laden in real anti-American rallies. Of course, the Muppet Masters, the Children's Television Workshop, were furious. They thought it was immoral for people to use Bert's image to support Osama bin Laden, but I think that was the least immoral thing going on that day. But it was a good example of how this idea, kind of in a fringe, a joke that wouldn't have gotten very far before the days of the web, got all the way to Bangladesh and Indonesia and wound up being projected on the world stage. And people actually took photographs of those Bert behind Osama bin Laden posters.
And Osama bin Laden's code name during the final operation that took his life was apparently Bert.
Yes, the association stayed until the very end. The SEAL team called him Bert.
It's an example of what you call virtual unreality. How would you define that term?
Virtual unreality is this... It's a state of being where things are no longer entirely real or entirely unreal, that we are filtering our reality through a new set of tools, through digital tools. Digital tools that help us view the world, digital tools that help us gather information, digital tools that help us disseminate information. And those digital tools sometimes work beautifully and help us and amplify our thoughts and project them, but sometimes they distort things in strange and subtle ways. And sometimes other people use them to distort our ideas. And we're becoming unaware of the fact that we are being digitally manipulated. And so virtual unreality is a state of being where we are dependent upon a new set of tools that have worked their way into our lives, and we're unaware that these tools are manipulating and controlling the information that we view.
Yeah, and you say at one point that it used to take an entire force of a totalitarian government to create an alternate reality, and now it can be done to smaller effect by a guy in his basement or sitting alone, you know, somewhere in Scotland, as we saw as another example in the book. How do we go from being an easy audience to this kind of unreality to being a skeptical one?
It's not so easy because it's a lot of work, and because there's so much information out there, one of the great things about digital information is that there's a huge amount out there, and everyone can put it on the web and publish. You go to Twitter, you go to Facebook, everyone's publishing, and so there's a huge amount of information out there. There's so much that we actually are dependent upon robots and filters to bring to us what we want to view. And so that creates a vulnerability. For example, with Wikipedia, all of us, if you're looking up something for the first time, you go to Wikipedia. It's fairly natural. It's a pretty good resource. But there are people putting false information in Wikipedia all the time, sometimes for jokes, sometimes to manipulate public opinion. My favorite example is of a baseball player, an outfielder named Mike Trout. And someone jokingly put in his Wikipedia entry that he had a nickname, the Millville Meteor, named after Millville, New Jersey, where he grew up. It wasn't true, but it became, because it was in Wikipedia, it was cited in a baseball encyclopedia and then wound up in the Daily News. And once it was in the Daily News, Wikipedia pointed to that Daily News article as proof that, yes, in fact, this guy is named the Millville Meteor. And all of a sudden, Mike Trout was baffled to notice that people were calling him the Millville Meteor. He had no idea where it came from. But now he's actually nicknamed the Millville Meteor. He's signing baseballs, the Millville Meteor, because someone created this idea in Wikipedia. And it turned from this falsehood into reality just by the force of being put in Wikipedia.
And advocates of the sort of crowdsourcing that Wikipedia does might say that this is good, that it's sort of a democratizing way to disseminate knowledge. What do you think about that argument?
Well, democracy is good, but the thing about knowledge is it's not democratic, that there are minority opinions that are, or even fringe opinions that are correct, and the majority is wrong, that you can't take a vote in this operating chamber to determine whether or not the heart has three or four chambers. It just is. It has four chambers. And the thing about Wikipedia, it's very powerful at gathering a huge amount of eclectic knowledge, and it's a very good resource. But because everyone is collaborating and voting on these ideas, it's not necessarily the best source. It's not accurate. It has the wisdom of crowds, but it also has the stupidity of crowds as well. So a reference written by a real expert is going to be better. But what's fascinating about Wikipedia is sometimes you have these experts joining in and trying to change Wikipedia entries to make them better, and they get overruled, and their edits get changed by the crowd.
You have an appendix in your book. It's called The Top 10 Dicta of the Internet Skeptic, and number one is, Wikipedia is like an old and eccentric uncle. Is that the way we should think about what we find there?
Yeah, yeah. It's fun to sit with your uncle. He can tell you a lot of stuff, and he knows a lot. He's been around. But sometimes he's been drinking a little too much. Sometimes his viewpoints are a little off. So if there's anything that's important to you, I mean, Wikipedia is a very good first stop to find something out, but if it's really important to you to know whether it's correct or not, Wikipedia is not the end of your journey. You should use Wikipedia to start out your searches and then go to more reliable, more authoritative sources.
Another piece of ground that you cover is social media, and you also write in the same appendix that social media's site's purpose is to serve its users in the same sense as a zoo's purpose is to serve its animals. So given the number of people who are involved every day in social media, what do we need to know to be skeptical and be savvy about how we use it?
Yeah, social media, I mean, if you think about it, it's a boon to all of us that we're able to keep in touch with our friends, we're able to tap into current trends. But the way that these social media companies make their money has nothing really directly to do with making you, the user, happy. It's making their advertisers happy, or their sponsors, the people who are paying money. And sponsors are made happy when you, the user, are exposed to new products and buy new stuff. And so it shouldn't be any surprise that social media companies aren't doing providing you with a platform out of the goodness of their heart. They're doing it to sell you products, and they're also doing it to extract information from you. And every few months, there's some sort of uproar as one of the major social media platforms, Twitter or Facebook is particularly bad at this, changes their privacy policy to do something that people find outrageous. And there's a complaint on the Internet for a few days, and then it disappears, and people continue using Facebook as they did before. But that means that Facebook is gathering a huge amount of information on how you do business, what websites you look at, how long you spend on these websites, whom you communicate with, why do you communicate with them. Now Facebook is going to be gathering information on sounds and what you're listening to. All this information is monetizable. It is valuable and is being gathered with your implicit consent, even if you're not aware of it. And this sort of information is not something you'd be giving the government or people outside of your close social circle. If the government were demanded to listen in on everything your cell phone was saying, you would rightly feel that this is the action of a totalitarian state. But when Facebook listens into all of your conversations online and possibly even to all the sounds in your room, that's progress. Everyone seems to be happy with it.
So given all of this, Wikipedia, social media, the ever-ready audience of the Internet, what specific tips or tools can you share to help us separate reality from unreality?
Oh, there's a few things. The first thing is anything that's important to you, always try to find the provenance of the information. Trace back a bit of information to where it comes from. It's not that hard to do it often. Start with Wikipedia and go through the references, see where they're getting their information from, and trace it backwards. Similarly, when someone tells you something, it's important to understand whether that is coming from a neutral point of view or a biased point of view. You have to figure out who that person is. And often online, it's not easy to figure out whether somebody's a real person or not. So in the book, I give you some tools like using image searches or using what are called IP addresses to try to trace back a person to his origin to see whether he's real or not or whether he is faking something. Generally speaking, it's just the book is attempting to make you aware of these manipulations that are going on. There's no fast and easy answer because these tools are very useful to us, that we're saving a huge amount of time by having robots do our news gathering for us. So we're not going to give it up. But we do have to be aware that this is a different way of life than it was just 10 years ago in a very concrete and scary way in some ways. So awareness is part of the battle, that when something comes through the news wires and it's breaking across all over Google News, just having that little sense of skepticism in your mind that there's a lot of manipulation out there, and taking a step back to see whether it's real rather than rushing on the bandwagon would benefit.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That was Charles Seif, the author of the book Virtual Unreality.
On this day, 25 years ago, Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing was released. Here's a clip in which a fight almost breaks out after a white biker runs over the character Buggin' Out's new sneakers.
Who told you to step on my sneakers? Who told you to walk on my side of the block? Who told you to be in my neighborhood?
I own this brownstone.
Who told you to buy a brownstone on my block, in my neighborhood, on my side of the street?
The movie takes place on a block in Brooklyn in one of New York City's poorest neighborhoods. African Americans and Puerto Ricans live on the block, and Korean and Italian Americans work there. The movie explored racial tensions and police brutality in a way that spoke to the whole nation and changed national conversations about race.
What's in your wallet right now? Maybe a credit card or two, debit card, maybe even some old-fashioned cold hard cash. Whatever you have, you probably think about it as a reflection of our concept of money. But what if a new virtual system of currency could replace some or even all of that?
Well, it might not be as far-fetched as it sounds. Our next guest says we're seeing an explosion of virtual currencies, from online credit card points to video game currencies like Second Life's Linden Dollar, not to mention private currencies like Bitcoin. He says the virtual and real economic worlds are intermingling more than ever, and that they could have some serious implications for the future of the global economy.
Joining us now is Edward Castronova. He's a professor of telecommunications and cognitive science at Indiana University. He's the author of the new book, Wildcat Currency, How the Virtual Money Revolution is Transforming the Economy. Edward, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, can you start by telling us what you mean by a virtual currency?
Well, it could apply to a lot of things. I mean, in a way, all money is virtual in some sense. The only reason people will accept money from you, the only reason you have value in it is because other people will accept it from you. That's true of the dollar as it is for these virtual gold pieces. But to answer the question directly, when I say virtual currencies, I mean ones that are digital. They're coming out of the digital environment and people are using them to trade.
And that could be anywhere from, as you write in your book, gold coins, virtual gold coins in World of Warcraft, to bitcoins that we see almost every day in the headlines lately.
Yeah, absolutely. Bitcoin is an example of a virtual currency where the basic idea was taken from video game currencies, but they said, forget the video game. Let's just do it in the real world. I mean, other examples are Litecoin and Nautilus coin. There's a whole bunch of these cryptocurrencies coming up now.
Why are we seeing such an explosion from the game world and in these substitute online currencies lately?
Well, first of all, money is as old as people, so that hasn't changed. Just, you know, people have used beaver pelts and cigarettes and gigantic stones as money, kind of as long as, you know, cow shells, as long as there's been people. But what's changing now is an aspect of digital technology. The games helped people to discover how you found and manage one of these currencies, and it's gotten to the point where the code required to do it is pretty well known, so that means anybody. You could have a WPR currency tomorrow if you wanted.
Are these, thinking of something outside the game world, let's get into something like Bitcoin. First of all, how does a virtual currency like Bitcoin work? How would we do it?
Well, from the standpoint of being just an ordinary user, you would you'd have a program called a wallet, okay, and it would live on your smartphone or on your computer. It'd be an icon. You'd click it or touch it or whatever. And that wallet would tell you this is how many crypto coins you have, and it would communicate with all the other wallets. So if you tried to give your bitcoins to somebody else, your wallet and the other person's wallet would report out to all the wallets in the world that this transaction has happened. And that reporting is what secures it. It's sort of like an automated central bank that watches every single transaction. But to you, it's just you click on a button on your computer and there's a number in there and it goes up and down with when you give away the bitcoins or when you accept them.
So what is the utility of something like Bitcoin or another virtual currency for me? What would I get out of it that I couldn't get with a credit card?
Well, there's sort of a negative answer there, which is when you use dollars, you get a whole bunch of stuff that you might not like regulations, oversight, and taxation. the real attraction of Bitcoins and these other currencies is that they kind of exist outside the normal channels. So it means they're very fluid. It's very easy to work with. And if you want to, it's easier to anonymize yourself with the cryptocurrencies. And at the moment, that's the biggest attraction.
So I can think of, not that I would put these into practice, a number of illegal things I could do with Bitcoins.
Right.
And is that how, at least in some measure, they're being used?
Well, that's sort of the starting point, right? So it's very natural for people to want to trade drugs using Bitcoins. And there was a big site called Silk Road, for example, that had millions and millions of dollars of transactions in Bitcoins every day. Now, the feds shut that down. And in fact, if you want to buy some Bitcoins, go to the U.S. Marshals site, and there's a whole bunch of them being auctioned off right now. And they come from, if you don't mind that your Bitcoins were acquired in drug trades. that's sort of the starting application is things that are illegal.
But is there a more legal use, not just for tax evasion or drug buying? Is there a benefit to me outside of that?
Well, I think the long run benefit is kind of like, let's imagine a situation where it's just barter. Like you want to borrow your neighbor's lawnmower and he wants to borrow your chainsaw, so you just exchange them. You may not know this, but when you do that, you generate a tax burden, okay? But you ignore it because it's like just a little side trade. Or mm-hmm. when you pay the kid to mow your lawn, you give him, you know, $15-$20 and no tax. I mean, technically there's a tax burden, but you don't actually pay it. Well, Bitcoins and other cryptocurrencies take that kind of common sense and make it global, right? So it's just all of your transactions. Like, why exactly do I have to pay a tax on this, that, and the other? And, economists and policy people say, well, of course you have to pay a tax on that. You know, it's if you pay with dollars or Bitcoins, it should be taxed the same. But the cryptocurrencies kind of walk into a world where people aren't necessarily thinking about the taxes they might owe. And so people might evade taxes not because they're doing something illegal, but just because it's more convenient. It's convenient to use your Bitcoins. There's a guy in Indianapolis, a dentist, who accepts Bitcoins for cleaning teeth. And if you used your Bitcoins, well, you know, maybe he doesn't have to pay taxes on it.
Well, I could see a use too internationally. Obviously, people online can buy from people in other countries. Do I need to worry about turning my dollars into rupees or euros or something like that if we can consent to use this common currency of a Bitcoin or other virtual currency? Is that a common use of that as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's an example of the ease and fluidity that virtual currencies allow that mainline currencies kind of don't. I mean, think of it as Skype for money. You know, and Skype is a program, for those of you who don't know, that just has made it really, really easy to just call people using your computer. And it just sounds beautiful and it works really, really well. And it sort of emerged without AT&T or any of the big companies knowing about it. And this is what's happening with currencies as well.
In a world with, as I mentioned, dollars, euros, rupees, and yen, people invest from one to the other to try to make money. Have people tried mm-hmm. to do that with virtual currency as well?
Absolutely. Right now, Bitcoin would classify as an exciting, risky investment. The scale is still small enough that one really, you know, anxious fellow in Cyprus can drive the Bitcoin to dollar exchange rate up and down kind of at will. So if you're sort of reading, if you're into doing the kind of things like reading tea leaves and making investments based on that, Bitcoin would be a fun thing to put your money into. But don't put your life savings in. I don't recommend it.
Well, let's turn to the gaming economy too. And I know you've studied sure. that a lot. A lot of people might assume that, you know, okay, people are online buying swords and horses and things like that in a fantasy yeah. online world with virtual coins. But out of that emerges a real economy that sometimes spreads into the real world. Can you talk through that?
Well, I think the virtual currencies are the best example of how that's happened. I guess you have to think about where does value come from? And I don't mean to get completely philosophical, but understand that people will pay extra money so that their car can be red, or you'll pay money so that the things in your ears are real diamonds, not fake diamonds. And what are you buying there? You know, that's a very intangible thing. So we do spend money and time to acquire intangible things, and we do call them valuable. That's what's happened in these games, right? There's a hierarchy there. You know, I have the best sword. I have the best armor. Look how good my character looks. And people will invest time and money to acquire those things. Again, that's as old as people. Where it jumps out into the real world is when somebody says, you know, I want to look good. I want to have that armor, but I don't have the gold pieces. Will you accept dollars and give me the armor instead? And, you know, people say, sure, you know, I'd rather have dollars than the armor. The trade happens. And so the game economy becomes real at that point.
And is that usually against the rules, with the rules, or sort of beside the rules when it comes to the people who are moderating and running these gaming websites?
Well, when you ask game scholars about rules, then you get a huge cultural discussion. Like, what are the rules? So in the United States, for the most part, the game companies are against them. So the terms of service of the game say you're not allowed to make those kind of trades. And culturally in the United States and Europe, we're like, that's cheating. You know, just because your dad's a dentist and you have a lot of money, you shouldn't have the best armor. But if you go to a place like Korea, it's like, absolutely, please spend as much money as you want to acquire powerful items. And everybody in the country assumes that that's how you play, right? You make money in the real world and you blow it in the video games to become the emperor of the universe.
We're talking with Edward Castronova. He's the author of the new book, Wildcat Currency, about the role virtual currencies play in today's society and the impact they could have on the global economy going forward.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you ever used one of these virtual currencies? And what was your experience like? And what role should they play in our economy going forward? 800-642-1234 is our number. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with author Edward Castronova about the rise of private and virtual currencies and how they could impact the economy going forward.
You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you ever bought or traded with a Bitcoin? Or have you used virtual currency maybe in the world of online gaming? Have you ever sold it or paid money for it? Do you have questions about how all this is going to work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We've got Jeff on the line in Viroqua. Jeff, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm driving. I'm going to try to pull over because I'm calling from the Christmas area of Wisconsin. There's lots of ups and downs. Signals come and go. But yes, sorry for the digression.
Jeff, I think you were digressing, but we're also kind of losing you there. Yep.
Okay.
But Jeff says he has some experience with Bitcoin. He wants to participate. Seems like a good idea. You talked a little bit, Edward, about how someone would get into Bitcoins. How many people are out there using Bitcoin and other real-world virtual currencies?
Well, you know, there aren't any general survey data about people using these things, but my sense is that there's a large fraction of people who are sort of digitally literate, you might say, who are familiar with Bitcoins and probably have an account. And an increasing number of corporations, mainstream corporations, are starting to accept them. So I guess the Dish TV network just recently announced that they were accepting Bitcoins. And then there's like a third community, I would say, is people who are really excited about mining Bitcoins. So there's a little faucet that you can turn on with your own computer that may eventually give you a Bitcoin for free, and it's called mining. And there are people who are putting some serious technology into mining these things by, you know, having rooms full of computers. But we don't know how many precisely. It just seems to be growing.
All right, we'll go now to Linda with us in Green Bay. Linda, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm just curious as to finding out how would you know who's involved in the trade? You know, like, how do I know my neighbor is or isn't?
Well, that's a good question. You know, Bitcoin is an anonymous form of trading. So in principle, if you get a Bitcoin, you don't know exactly whose hands have been on it. You'll know which wallets have done it, but the wallets are not necessarily connected to the people in any way that you can know. So you wouldn't know unless they came up to you and said, hey, you want a Bitcoin, and you had your smartphones talk to each other.
Now, we keep saying Bitcoin, and honestly, that's the one I'm familiar with. Bitcoin isn't the only game in town and isn't necessarily the future of virtual currency, as you write.
Yeah, Rob, that's really important to emphasize. There's quite a lot of discussion of one particular currency right now, but I think it's kind of like social media back in 2005, 2006, when we had MySpace and Friendster and Orkut and LinkedIn, and then this new thing called Facebook came along, and it solved a number of those, the personal or psychological issues around social media. It solved them just right and took over, and I think I'm a little bit skeptical about Bitcoin. I think it has some problems in terms of, you know, the average person taking it up. So it may not dominate in the long run.
Well, supposing it or some other currency does take over, become very popular, one of the concerns you raise or issues that some people have is that if you have all of this currency in, say, the United States, outside of the ability of the Federal Reserve to kind of tweak and tamper with as efficiently as it can, it makes it harder for the government to have an economic policy.
Absolutely. We're all living in an extended period where there's been one state currency that has been directly managed by a central bank. And if you go back before World War II and before World War I, it was pretty common for there to be lots of private currencies going around. And in that era, there were more financial panics, and it was hard for the government to control the economy, for better or worse. You know, depending on your politics, some people say it's great, some people say it's a disaster. But the fact is, you know, when you have a lot of rogue currencies running around, historically, that's been a real problem for governments.
And one other possibility you raise, kind of flipping this on its head, is that in the future, with all these simulations available, the government can do tests of future monetary policy by testing them in virtual online worlds.
Yeah, that sort of speaks to a general thing I'm excited about. With virtual worlds, we have the ability to simulate all kinds of important social changes. And people who run these big games, if they put out a new policy, they test it a lot before they do so. Whereas in the real world, we come up with a policy and we're like, bam, there it is. And so it just seems to me that with monetary policy and a lot of other kinds of policies, you could set up little petri dish virtual worlds and test them out first before you unleash them on the public. That's kind of a research trajectory that might be exciting to pursue.
That's one of your hopes for what government might do with this concept. You also have some thoughts on what governments should and shouldn't do when it comes to the laws and regulations related to virtual currency. What do you have in mind?
Right. Well, my study of this subject makes me convinced that there isn't a sort of a technical or natural boundary between the dollar and the Bitcoin and the gold piece, that they're all sort of forms of money. And yet, I think we should have some dividing lines. And so that's going to be up to us to kind of put those lines in place. And one important line is between the area of games and fantasy and the area of like the real serious economy. It would be a mistake to try to tax and regulate gold pieces in some video game. That would kill the game. At the same time, it's probably going to be a mistake to just say, well, you know, we're going to let any currency or any form of monetary interaction that looks like a game to just sort of live free in the real world, because then, you know, that creates quite a lot of opportunities for abuse. So we're going to have to be careful about how we treat the different currencies and the different game worlds or virtual worlds, synthetic worlds, based on what they're trying to do and what they're for.
Under current law, if I wanted to start a Robcoin, or you mentioned a WPR coin, is there any law that says we can't do that apart from not making it look exactly like a Federal Reserve note?
No, you hit it, Rob. That's the only thing. You can't make it look like a U.S. dollar, but otherwise you can make it up. And so anything you want, it's perfectly legal. People in America have been making their own coins for a long, long time. That's nothing new. In the Depression, for example. And now we have things like a pot coin that came out of Denver that's themed around marijuana. And there's pink coin. If you use pink coin, it supports breast cancer research. So I could see a proliferation of these currencies just based on things like public interest movements and charities and and social and religious clubs. You know, the sky's the limit.
That next question or two are kind of maybe more geared toward the science fiction novelist in you, if there is one. But looking toward the future, is there a possibility that we start to see a withering away of the state money and corporate or some other alternatives that transcend national boundaries?
Well, you know, you want to use history as a guide. So historically, people have used money for different reasons. Different forms of money solve different problems, better or worse. State-backed currencies are very stable, secure. Okay, so there's always going to be a role for that. There's going to be some of your economic life that you want to have in those kinds of currencies. But at the same time, the economy also really likes fluidity. It likes freedom. It likes chaos, creative destruction. So there's always going to be a need for that. And so I don't see state currencies withering away, but it wouldn't surprise me if they occupy a smaller fraction of economic trade than they do today.
Then I could see another possible future, a sort of Tower of Babel of money, where you have a whole bunch of state currencies and Bitcoin or whatever takes over, and Pinkcoin and Dogecoin and all these individual little things. And how do we figure out how they interact with each other?
Well, there's a side of me that says that the real opportunity here isn't in the coins. It's in something that I called digital value transfer systems. That is software that manages this proliferation, this Pandora's box of money, and allows people to sort of seamlessly transfer their purchasing power among them all. So, for example, Facebook for a while had its own currency, Facebook credits. And they said, why are we doing this? They said instead, anybody who has an application on our system can invent their own currency, and we will simply transfer the value back and forth between the currencies behind the scenes. And that might be the truly long-run play in this space.
Metacurrency.
Exactly.
Edward, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Very interesting.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Veronica. Shout out to everybody in Madison where I got my PhD.
Oh, well, welcome back. Welcome back via the phone lines. That was Edward Castronova. He's a professor of telecommunications and cognitive science at Indiana University. He's the author of the new book, Wildcat Currency, How the Virtual Money Revolution is Transforming the Economy.